Before we get started, I want to thank again our event sponsors, Dominion Energy and Bank of America Merrill Lynch, our presenting sponsors, Comcast, our major sponsor, and our supporting sponsors, Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer, and Aspira Public Affairs. And again, I want to thank Maria O'Mara and KUER for engaging in this partnership with us, for thinking of a new way to bring people together, again, in a dialogue about things that we cannot ignore, that we can't talk about this enough, I guess. That's what I would say. And if you were at the reception with Scott Ulbrich before calling our attention to what happened in New York, if you think about what happens every week in our country, every day around the world, there's a lot of work to do. We're glad you're here. We're glad that you do that work every day. We can do it together and go farther. And thanks again. I want to introduce or invite Maria to come up and welcome our speaker and introduce our panel.
Well, thank you all very much for being here tonight. Thank you to Bill and the United Way. We really are honored to be part of a partnership of deep thought and deep listening on the subject of education. Really hard to think of anything more pressing, more urgent for us as a community to be discussing. It's actually my pleasure tonight to introduce your host for the evening, and she will be a guide. We have found her to be a guide at our station as well. Julia Ritchie joined KUER just last year in October of 2016. She had been reporting at an NPR member station in Reno, mostly doing politics there, but also covering education, school overcrowding. She says really any story that got her to Tahoe. Her work had already been well recognized with the three regional Edward R. Murrow Awards. Julia is originally from Western North Carolina. She graduated from UNC Chapel Hill in 2008 with a degree in journalism. She's done both print and radio reporting. She says her curiosity about the West led her to take a spontaneous one-way road trip to the Great Basin. And she continues to preach the gospel of community journalism, public radio, and podcasting. And she is most definitely the guide and the conscience of our station when it comes to staying attentive to social media and to all the new and very important ways that our community is connecting. And she will be a wonderful guide tonight. So everyone, please give a round of applause to Julia Ritchie.
Okay, I know what you guys are thinking. Doesn't have kids in school, doesn't speak Spanish, doesn't report on education. Let's let the white chick lead this discussion on Latinos in education. So, with that disclaimer, I just want to say I am actually the perfect audience for this discussion tonight. I'm exactly the type of person who needs to learn more about these issues. So what I hope to do a lot of tonight is listen. And join you in doing that as well. Hopefully I'll ask some good questions, but if that doesn't happen, I know our panel will take care of me. Right now in Utah, Latinos are the largest and fastest growing population in our state. About 1 in 7 Utahns identifies as Hispanic or Latino. The same goes for our school-aged children. I think between like 35-40% is what I looked up before I got here, are Latinos. So it's a huge population. Maybe we don't acknowledge it enough, right, because we look at Utah and we think it's a predominantly white state, but that's changing. And with that, we have to acknowledge the education attainment gap, the achievement gap we talk about a lot. So I'm really excited about who we have to discuss these things because he's been reporting on this a long time. So I'm not going to ramble on too long. I'm going to read you Claudio's bio and bring him on stage. Claudio Sanchez is an education correspondent for NPR, former elementary and middle school teacher, just like our education reporter, Lee Hale. He focuses on the three P's of education: reform, politics, policy, and pedagogy. Sanchez's reports air regularly on NPR's award-winning news magazines, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition. In 2008, Sanchez won first prize in the Education Writers Association's National Awards for Education Reporting for his series, The Student Loan Crisis. He was named as a Class of 2007 Fellow by the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University, and in addition to a lot of other awards, which I won't be listing. Sanchez is a native of Mexico and a graduate of Northern Arizona University with a post-baccalaureate at the University of Arizona in Tucson. So let's bring Claudio on stage. You're welcome.
Time to vent.
Yeah, you said you wanted to tell people a little bit about yourself, especially if they haven't heard of you before, although you've been on the air for quite some time, right?
Yes, and don't remind me, please. I wanted not so much to give this any structure, because I'm really looking forward to the Q&A, the questions you all have. But I guess in the name of just being able to tell you a little bit about myself and blending in some of the issues that I know we're going to talk on with panelists. And I'd like to just read just some prepared remarks. I come from a part of the world where an education is the only lifeline for those who start life with very little. My home, Nogales, Sonora, Mexico, and Nogales, Arizona, are twin cities that straddle a 2,000-mile-long border built on exploitation, profound inequity, everything along the border collides. Economies, language, social mores, cultures, traditions, and history itself. When my parents separated, my father, a man with a sixth-grade education, left to work in the alfalfa fields in Peoria, Arizona. My mother, an ambitious woman, eventually grew tired of Mexico. All she saw was poor people imprisoned by the fatalism. My mother, a voracious reader with 2 years of college, thanks to the philanthropy of an old priest, was convinced that as a single parent, life would be easier in the United States, even though, in a strange way, we felt poorer in this country than we had ever felt in Mexico. My mother was a great believer in the power of a good education. She was convinced that our appearance, the way we carried ourselves, the precision of our speech, our vocabulary, would pave our way to a better life. And most important of all, she would say, you must hold on to your dignity like your life depends on it. So growing up in the U.S., the key lesson for me early on was that the process of assimilation quickly brings all immigrants and the children of immigrants to a crossroads, an identity crisis of sorts. At Nogales High School, 90% of the students were Mexican-American, mostly poor. Speaking English with a thick accent was a curse. Losing your accent meant you were ready to move up among the kids who wore their assimilation proudly. Only then could you dare mingle with the wealthy kids who ran the school the way their parents ran the city's economy and politics. I remember wanting desperately to shed my alienhood, but realizing that because of how I looked, I would forever be labeled resident alien, Mexican-American, Chicano, Pocho, Hispanic, her panic, your panic, our panic, as my mother would often joke. Now, I'm sharing this with you because, just like you, I have a special appreciation for the subject at hand, the value of an education, its power to transform, and its power to pave the path to the opportunity and prosperity that we all seek. And isn't that, after all, the true genius of America? A chance for all of us, for you, to reinvent yourself over and over. And yet, our nation today is in the midst of its own identity crisis, economic mobility, opportunity, and doubts about the American dream itself feed our collective angst. As Harvard social scientist Robert Putnam puts it in his important new book, Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis, this nation's class and racial divide is in large part the result of our own growing educational divide. But don't bother looking for villains, says Putnam, because our social and educational policies reflect collective decisions. We are all to blame for the dysfunction of our schools, our K-12 education system, and its failure to adequately prepare kids for career or college, let alone address the plight of poor, undereducated, marginalized children and families. Today, more and more Americans believe opportunity itself is at risk, the kind of opportunity that my mother sought for her children, the kind we earn by working hard, because that's what America rewards. As Putnam puts it, most Americans don't begrudge success or wealth and those who've earned it through hard work. They begrudge the lack of opportunity. Thank you for listening. So.
It's hard to follow that. I kind of do want to take us back to, because you just talked about your upbringing there, what led you to become a teacher before you decided to get into journalism and storytelling?
My first year as a teacher, and it was all, pretty accidental. I was out of money. I had gone to Mexico City to freelance and came back to my home, Nogales, and then to Tucson, because it was so hard to earn a living as a journalist. Remember, back then, everybody wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein, but newspapers weren't hiring, and I was essentially a print reporter. So I tried my hand in freelancing, and then a friend of mine said, "Claudia, you know, they need a Spanish teacher over at this school. You may want to look into it." The pay was $9,000 a year. But it was $9,000 more than what I had. And it was a residential school. It was half the kids were filthy rich, half the kids were really dirt poor. It was an interesting place. And I remember just starting there, teaching English as a second language, Spanish as a second language. I coached the soccer team that never won a game while I was there. I cooked on the weekends. My kids loved the French toast I made, and I loved flying kites with them on Sundays. I drove the school bus, and I also taught a writing course for the older kids. It was a K through 9th, 10th grade. But going back to your question, the reason I liked teaching, and I thought this is my calling my first year, was because of the joy that I had in teaching, even the most difficult kids. And this was a school that essentially resembled what I thought was a good cross-section of most American schools. Native American kids, Latino kids, Anglo kids, Asian kids. And they were so much fun. I really thoroughly enjoyed teaching these kids. Now, maybe the feeling wasn't mutual. I wasn't exactly their favorite teacher either. But my second year, when all the teachers who had been angry about how much they were getting paid left, we hired a bunch of people literally off the street. And the school fell apart. I lost my mentors. I lost a sense of direction. I lost friends, educators, wonderful educators who had left. And all of a sudden, these kids became this insurmountable challenge. And as you know, in a story I wrote, in an essay I wrote about going back to that school, I felt that I was going to do more damage than good. And it's something that I keep kind of reliving every time I visit a school where I know teachers don't belong in the classroom. I've met teachers who say, "I'm doing this because I don't know what else to do." And I often end up pleading with folks like that. And they're a minority. They're truly a minority. But I plead with them and I say, don't stay in teaching if you don't love these children. Who knows if it has an impact or not. But I see, again, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, I see myself in many of these teachers. And when I come across wonderful teachers, I envy them. Because deep down, I say to myself, you know, if I had been a good teacher, I would have stayed in teaching. And I would have been truly satisfied. And felt, and would have felt that I was really giving something back. That I was making a difference, as the cliche goes.
I mean, that experience carries through to your reporting now, though. You can see that empathy that you have for the people in your stories.
Which
whether,
is a double-edged sword.
Yeah, educators or administrators, too.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes when you bring some of that to a story, maybe you're a little too close.
Too close? You feel that way sometimes?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Well, so about a year ago, you went back to the school where you had taught, and you had a lot of mixed feelings about it. It was a really, really powerful piece, about 7 minutes long, and I really want to play a clip from that because I think it gives a great window into your thinking about your time as an educator, but also about how you see education now and the role of teachers. So let's hope this plays. And we should say that you contact, or a student that you used to had contacted you, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to hear from him in this clip.
I mean, I struggled to reconcile my decision to leave teaching and the children I had grown so fond of, but I had quit after only 2 years. I felt I had failed as a teacher. I was young, and in hindsight, totally unprepared to deal with children who emotionally required so, so much.
Yeah, I think that would be a hard thing to come to terms with, being in that situation.
John understands more than I would have expected.
You were a victim of it, I guess, as much as the rest of us. So much of it was way beyond what one individual teacher could deal with. I mean, you couldn't change how they ran the place. I mean, you must have been, you know, in your early 20s in this crazy environment.
With all kinds of kids who had ended up at Treehaven for all kinds of reasons, among them John. A sweet, quiet boy who grew up without his parents, but who went on to get a PhD in physics, married, had 3 children, and today sounds like he's a happy human being.
I mean, you're now, in my view, an incredible success story from Treehaven.
Hmm.
Do you see yourself as a success?
I don't really think about that. I kind of think of myself as somebody who's kind of survived and can lead a fairly normal life.
And that, what John just said, brings me back to a question I've asked myself over and over. Did I have a role, no matter how small? Was I a good teacher?
You know, I think you were a good teacher. I think you were serious, but you cared.
That is very important for me to hear, John.
I feel, affection and gratitude for you and the other teachers. I mean, I don't have any feelings of you guys let us down. So,
listening to John, it dawns on me. This is what all teachers need to hear at some point in their careers, a validation of sorts, even if it's only from one student decades later.
The backstory about John and how he got a hold of me was that he had emailed me back in 1990-something and said, emailed NPR and said, is that Claudio Sanchez on the air, the same guy who taught at Treehaven? And the email made its way to me, and I kept it, but I thought, yeah, should I respond? And then I saw University of Washington Physics Department, and I said, wow. But when I went back to the school, I thought, I can't tell this story of having taught here without calling John. And John filled in all the blanks, and it was great. It was great. Because, as the piece said, it made the point that, you know, the thing about teaching is that you never know. I mean, you can't look into the future and say, this second grader is going to be it's going to be this or it's going to be that.
Mm-hmm.
There are no immediate rewards. All you can hope for is that, hey, you did a pretty good job and that whoever gets him or her in the future will do a good job as well. But teachers often don't know the impact they had. And when we've done stories about great teachers, we dedicated a couple of years ago a whole year to great teachers. And I even went to Kansas, Emporia, Kansas, to do a story about the National Teachers Hall of Fame, and came across so many examples of great teachers. But even these people don't know what impact they had on their kids. They just don't. So in many ways, it's a thankless job. So the people, you have to admire the people who go into this profession, clearly not for money, but for a sense of giving back. And I admire every teacher I meet, even the teachers who I feel are not up to snuff. I admire the guts they have to spend time with young people and to make that effort to shepherd them, to guide them, especially in cases when they have no one else to turn to.
I'm curious, because teacher retention is an issue in Utah. We have a problem with it, turnover, not being...
I think it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Do you see... But I was going to ask, do you see any place that's actually doing well, that's actually validating these teachers and ushering them through? Is there
well,
a program...
Well, those are two different questions. Validating teachers? No.
No.
But I think that there are policies that can keep teachers, good teachers, in their jobs. And it's not... Listen, it's not just about pay. It's not about the money. It's about the quality of the place at work. It's about getting credit where credit is due. It's about being acknowledged, being respected. And again, I speak about that in the sense that, you know, I wasn't in teaching long enough to know what it's like to be a teacher for 15 years and for people never to have said thank you. I wasn't in it long enough. But I can tell you, just by being in it 2 years, that teachers in this country are not appreciated. There's a culture in this country that doesn't value the teaching profession. You know, there's a great book out there if you ever come across it. It's called Learning to Bow. Learning to Bow was written by an English teacher who had gone to Japan and who came back and wrote a book about not so much comparing the U.S. and Japan and their education systems, but talking about the culture of support for teachers in Japan and talking about how Japanese teachers are embraced and are allowed to become part of an extended family, not just at school, but with the families, the parents, an extended family of children. That's valuing teachers. You know, you could argue that they get paid maybe a little bit more, that the work is much harder in Japan. My daughter, our daughter, Bianca, has been teaching in Japan for 2 years. And she says, Dad, you can't imagine how dedicated these teachers are. Not because they love kids or love teaching, but because they know that the culture values them. How you can change that in this country, I don't know.
And it's a big question. The demographic shift that we're seeing now in our school population also applies to teacher recruitment as well, right? To get teachers in the classroom that look more like their students. What have you come across in your reporting that is the biggest obstacle for that?
I think it's the pipeline. I mean, clearly there aren't enough Latino, African American, even Asian teachers who get into the profession. But remember that there's a burden on smart, gifted, Latino young people. And that burden often is economic. Teaching doesn't pay well, or as well as engineering, computer science, even medicine or law. And so there's this pressure on people who would otherwise have been wonderful teachers to break that barrier, that economic stagnation of Latino families. But the other is simply that, you know, that I think the recruitment of these minority teachers is half-hearted. Very few examples. I mean, very few exceptions. I did a story about African-American male teachers who are only 2% of teachers in this country, and went down to Clemson University, which has the first and one of the few programs that recruits and spends money and resources on recruiting young black men. And and guides them and gives them all the resources and then supports them even when they start a job. Well, you know, if you talk to these young men, they say, this is my calling, but they don't last very long. And so if you look at exceptional programs like this, they're so rare. Kansas City, interestingly, had a huge, huge effort about 10, 15 years ago to try and recruit more minority teachers. And it had pretty decent funding. And it fell apart. But the key to it was, the people who they recruited, the key to it was that they were able to pay the first 2 years of college for these young people. I mean, that, as a policy, makes sense. If you're going to, you know, disadvantaged communities, and you're saying, we want your son or daughter to be a great teacher, and you nurture these folks through a pipeline, and then they hit the college age, but they don't have money, the families don't have money to go to college, then it all stops. Kansas City had said, we can help support these young people. Again, it costs money, and not very many school districts or states are willing to spend it.
And I think you mentioned this in the reception downstairs, that it's not a winning political issue either, right? Because you have to get funding, you have to elect people that want to give it funding, correct?
Sure. And, you know, I mean, when was the last time that you heard that an election hinged on education? I mean, you know, Roy Romer, who was the head of the DNC, Democratic National Committee, and then was governor of Colorado and was also spent 6 years as superintendent of public schools in Los Angeles, of all places. We profiled him back then, and he said, this is the hardest job I've ever done. Soon after he left that job, he went out and said, why doesn't education get the support or the attention it deserves? And he spent 6 months traveling the country. And at every stop, he describes sitting across a kitchen table with families and asking them, is education important to you? And of course it is. Would you vote for a candidate that you supported because of his or her stance on education? They said, probably not. Why? Because it's jobs, foreign policy, terrorism. I mean, it's things that overshadow such a fundamental thing. Remember that a nation at risk in 1983 said to us, if a foreign power did to our schools, I'm paraphrasing, did to our schools what has been done to them, we would consider it an act of war. And we launched this alarmist campaign to say that Americans were falling so far behind that our own national security was threatened. Where has that message gone? Even if it was alarmist, did it wake people up? It did not, in my view.
You're based in D.C., where the Department of Education...
Don't remind me.
That is where the Department of Education is, though. And I am curious how, if it feels different now. I mean, you're covering policies that are coming out of the Department of Education. Probably had one of the most controversial picks for Secretary of Education.
When you say now, are you talking about the Trump and DeVos
administration? Correct, yes. That is who I'm referring to.
It feels different, but I keep reminding people, and Lee knows this. I think I've mentioned it to him when he was with us up in Washington. When people somehow, you know, began to panic about the Trump administration policies on education, certainly DeVos as a, at the very best, questionable candidate to become secretary because of all the questions about her record in Michigan. I remind people that dysfunction at the department is nothing new. So, is that Lee? No, but I remind them that, you know, when I arrived in Washington under the first Bush administration, the Bush administration was doing very poorly in its certainly being perceived, especially by Latinos, as anti-Latino. So they go ahead and pick the former dean of the medical school at Tufts, a man named Lauro Cavazos, I don't know if anybody remembers him. Lauro Cavazos, brilliant academician and even a medical guy, was handpicked to lead the Department of Education. And Lauro Cavazos was a disaster. He was, when people say DeVos is inaccessible, and those stories run about just about every week now, Lauro Cavazos was inaccessible because he was and turned out to be an embarrassment for the administration. He didn't know what he was doing. He had minders kind of in front of reporters remind him what he was supposed to be talking about. Mm-hmm. But his biggest sin, as far as the Latino community was concerned, was going down to San Antonio for a conference and essentially wagging his finger at Latino parents in the audience and saying to them, you are the blame for your children's failure. You are the reason our community has been so trodden upon because they don't have an education and it's your fault. That didn't go across very well. And to this day, I think people remember Lauro Cavazos as maybe a man with good intentions, but a total failure as a Secretary of Education, let alone the fact that back then, you know, the Department of Education was using something called the wall chart to evaluate schools. What was it? What was the wall chart? You know what it was? It was a ranking of states based on SAT and ACT scores. That's it. That was it. I mean, talk about a distorted picture of American schools and American kids.
Are you starting to see the issues that will define this current administration's education policy?
No.
No.
It's a mixed bag. We're caught up in this toxic political environment in which it doesn't matter what DeVos says or does. It doesn't get the attention even from national reporters because something else is going to replace it on the evening news. If it was at any other time and you heard that Secretary DeVos has spent so much time visiting private charters or private schools, charter schools and private schools, to the dismay of public education advocates, that would have made headlines. That would have made news. Because you have a Secretary of Education who is supposed to represent 95-94% of all children in this country who go to public schools. And the neglect or the disinterest in seeing or making sure that those schools do well is alarming. It doesn't get attention because it's competing with so many other things that are pretty outrageous these days in Washington. And I'm not just talking about Trump tweeting, by the way. I'm talking about an environment in Washington in which is why I said don't remind me. I'm reminded all the time that education does not belong in Washington. It gets distorted. The misinformation about the federal role, the state role, the local role, it all gets caught up in the most meaningless, stupid arguments. It doesn't matter whether you're at the White House or in Congress. There are good members of Congress who understand education, but who have little or no sway. That's why most educators, teachers in particular, say to themselves, all we can do is wait this out. What difference is the federal government going to make in the way I teach math? In Margarita's, you know, learning disability? It's not going to make a difference. It's too far removed from the reality of what's going on in schools.
One area, though, that has crossed over, right, is immigration and the education of immigrant children, which I know we're going to bring our panel up in a minute to talk a little bit more about. But I wanted to reference another clip that I want to play here about a story you did. You went to Tijuana. Do you want to talk about this story?
Well, the assignment was UCLA and Patricia Gandara, their head lead researcher, had gone down to Mexico 2 years before to commiserate, to talk to her fellow researchers out of some of Mexico's most prominent colleges. And, you know, she created a campaign called The Students We Share. And her big issue was that the Obama administration in 2006 began deporting in huge numbers, mostly Mexican immigrants, but also Central American immigrants. And Mexico was receiving many of these deported families with school-aged children who were born in the United States. They were U.S. born, but they couldn't stay in the United States if they were, you know, ages 6 to 12, 15. So they were going back, and the Mexican schools were saying, you don't know Spanish. Come back when you know Spanish. I mean, there is little or no support for kids in Mexico who don't know the language. I mean, its history with indigenous peoples is pretty well documented. So Patricia says, we need to do something about this. And we're talking about 800,000 children, by the way. Almost a million children returning to Mexico, mostly to Baja California and Chihuahua for some reason, border states. And so Patricia told me, Claudio, you know, look at what Tijuana has done. Tijuana had embraced these kids, had created and found the resources to create special programs for them. So I visited a school, and that's where I met the 9-year-old that you're going to hear.
One study of 1,500 U.S.-born children in Mexican schools found that, with very few exceptions, like the model program in Tijuana, these kids get little or no support. Many are held back in grade. Some stop going to school. Invisibles, the invisible ones, that's what researchers call them. Which brings us back to 9-year-old Anthony. He's thriving because he gets so much academic and emotional support. But there's something else about Anthony. He seems to be learning a lot about himself and the world he left behind in Barstow, California.
I was never white when I was at Barstow, always brown. Yeah. I see myself more Mexican. Yeah. Like my color, I belong in Mexico. This is my home. Yeah.
Anthony says he'll return to the U.S. someday. He is, after all, a U.S. citizen by birth.
What was extraordinary about Anthony was his level of sophistication and understanding of identity. You know, it wasn't just that he was looking at his skin and saying, look, I'm brown. I was never white. As, from a child's point of view, he was saying, I didn't belong. And I never looked at where he went to school in Barstow or what school he went to, but I bet you that sense that he didn't belong didn't have so much to do with his skin. I think it had to do with how he was treated. Was he made to feel that he belonged? I doubt that very much. The flip side, of course, is that Anthony, and I'm going to go visit him again. This story aired earlier this year.
I think, about spring or so.
Yeah. I want to go back and see what happened to Anthony. He's just one of those compelling stories that, you know, you want to know, how's he doing? How's he doing? How does he feel now, you know, several months later? And maybe even a year from now.
I mean, did that give you a insight into his U.S. education? I mean, because all of these children coming down here have received some formalized education.
It's a mix. Many of the other kids who I met said, I love my school. I was learning both English and Spanish. My parents felt welcome. Then there were the kids, many of whom I met. They were in the same piece, but kids who felt ostracized on both sides of the border. They were stigmatized. They arrived stigmatized, and their parents were, in many cases, parents who had had little or no relationship with their school. So in Mexico, they're in a double bind. They are people who have not had a good experience with their school. The young ones say, I don't belong in either place. And I say to myself, that's a terrible feeling, not knowing where you belong. And not, in terms of identity, not knowing, you know, where do I fit? Where do I fit? And if you think about the age of these kids, you know, like 9-year-old and up to teenagers are the ones who I found struggle the most. Because think about it. Think about where a teenager's mind is. And then on top of that, you have this layer upon layer of stress and responsibility. You know, your parents don't know what to do with you. You have no one at school to speak with. And so I think, you know, I just really, it's really sad to see some of these kids. And, you know, Patricia Gandara herself feels that we're losing a generation. And if we don't do something, if the Mexican government doesn't do something to help them, forget what the U.S. is doing. I mean, at this point, those 800,000 kids are going to get lost in Mexico. They're already lost in many ways.
It's it's a story that I had never heard of before I had started doing research on this. Another vulnerable population you've been doing a lot of reporting on are DACA students. So I think
which is why I'm glad we have someone on our panel.
Exactly. I think this is a natural segue to bring up our panelists on stage and maybe dive into that topic a little bit. So if I could have the two panelists come on stage and I'll introduce you all. I'll start reading this. So our first panelist is Gerardo Lopez. He is a professor and chair of the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy at the University of Utah. His research interests are in parent involvement, school community relations, and immigrant education. He's the co-author of Persistent Inequality, Contemporary Realities in the Education of Undocumented Latino Students. He's published over 50 articles, book chapters, and scholarly products in academic journals, such as the Harvard Educational Review, among many others. His current research focuses on Latino parent engagement in the state of Utah, which is a really cool topic, with a focus on identifying new pathways and policy windows for engagement with this community. So thank you for joining us, Gerardo. And then we also have Ciriac Alvarez Valle. I say that okay? She's a proud Mexican-American and undocumented immigrant. She's really passionate about immigrant rights and educational equity, community organizer, a poet, a writer, who's using her voice online to advocate for immigrants as well as their access to higher education. In 2014, she co-founded Somos Dreamers and Utah Dreamers Advising Corps, two student groups dedicated to advocacy at the U. She also helped create the first official Dream Center in Utah. And then you graduated just in May with a bachelor's in political science and honors sociology, and you work at the Consulate of Mexico in Salt Lake City in community affairs, working on education, health, and community empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I should mention that Ciriac has been interviewed 3 times on NPR by Lourdes Garcia Navarro. So
we might as well employ her.
Right? I know. Should. She's kind of an NPR celebrity in her own right, right? But what Lourdes has been checking in with you, right, is as this year has unfolded, you graduated in May. In September, President Trump announced he was going to rescind DACA, which you currently are a recipient of. You know, why share your story now?
I think sharing our story is important in general. I wouldn't say now it's more important, but I would say that it's important to have someone know that there are undocumented immigrants here in the state of Utah. I think we have this idea that because we're a majority of white, majority Mormon, we often believe that undocumented immigrants don't live here in Utah, but there are 10,500 DACA recipients who are at risk of losing their DACA today, tomorrow, March 5th. And so telling my story, being able to tell people that I'm undocumented and unafraid, lets them know that we exist and we're here to stay.
You were brought to Utah at age 5, correct?
I immigrated. Because if we say brought, we oftentimes blame our parents for trying to hope for a better future of my family and families like mine.
And I appreciate the feedback on that. You went to Highland High School, and you told me on the phone when we talked last week about how it was that you couldn't tell anyone until you got to the point where I think you were getting ready to go to college and you went to your high school guidance counselor. And just recount that for me, because it was, again, another eye-opening thing for me as a white person.
So I was senior class president. I was the top of my class. I did community service. I was part of different clubs and organizations, and I went to my college advisor and asked her for scholarships, and she gave me about a pack of 12 different scholarships that she thought I was eligible for. But the first requirement was a social security number, a number I didn't have. And so I threw them away and just didn't come back. And she hunted me down a couple weeks later and said, why haven't you applied to any of these? And because I didn't have anything that I could actually tell her, the only thing that came out was the truth, and I said, well, I'm undocumented. I can't apply to any of these. And all she could say was, well, I don't know what to do. And at that moment, my heart sunk because going to college has always been what I've wanted to do. It's always been an aspiration of mine, especially because my older brother and older sister couldn't go. So hearing those words say, like, I don't know what to do, well, I didn't know what to do because I would be a first-generation college student, was really disheartening.
Claudio, do you see that, and because you've done some reporting on this, that administrators and teachers in schools don't know how to talk to this population, to these students?
It's not so much that they don't know. They don't think they're responsible. I mean, unless they take a real interest in a student, teachers are hands-off. I mean, what am I going to do or say that is going to help this kid? You know, straighten out their legal status. Remember that DACA really is the byproduct of a failed immigration policy. That's really what it boils down to. But it's also the reason why it gets dragged into, again, that toxic debate about who's legal, who's not, who should come, who shouldn't come. And that's not going to get resolved anytime soon. I would hope that the Congress, by March 5th of next year, that's their deadline, will resolve, at least in the short term, what to do with almost a million DACA students now. I think it's a long shot. I really do. I remember when, President Trump said, we're giving Congress this much time. A lot of people in the DACA advocacy community was saying, yeah, it's now so urgent that people are going to definitely, and certainly Republicans don't want the albatross of this issue on their heads going into a campaign season in 2018. But don't be surprised if maybe you won't see a deportation force, but if this doesn't get resolved, you will see DACA students, we've already seen some of them, deported. I have to tell a story here, though, because, you know, at the risk of preaching to the choir, right, which I think is not always good, I heard of a story. The Education Writers Association had a whole symposium on DACA a few months back, and I was spending time with some reporters out of Georgia, Latino reporters who were covering the issue for their weekly Spanish language newspaper. And one reporter was saying to me, look, he said, I ran a story about a young woman, Ecuadorian, legal status, she was a U.S. citizen, who had started working for McDonald's. And a few weeks later, a kid from Mexico who was DACA eligible started working there as well. That kid moved up to assistant manager very quickly, a job that this young woman said was hers. She goes home, tells her mother. The mother raises hell. I mean, she goes to McDonald's, says, you hired this illegal before you hired my daughter. We're talking about an Ecuadorian family here. The point of the story and the response to it was amazing, where this reporter was saying, we had people coming out of the woodwork, other Latinos, who felt that these DACA kids were getting all this attention, and their kids who had been born in this country and or had come across legally were being shortchanged, were being ignored. Now, I ask myself, is that a legitimate story? Because DACA divides not just Latinos, non-Latinos, citizens and non-citizens, or non-legal residents. It divides us all because of a very fundamental truth, which is, for many immigrants in this country, if I came across legally, why are others being allowed to come illegally? Now, the stories that you hear from DACA students are very powerful, because you ask yourself, how could you deny anyone, like a young woman, from reaching those dreams and doing for this country what every immigrant group has done, make this a better country? Well, I think that the reason it's so hard to emotionally resolve this is because we have way too many Americans who feel that somehow there is preferential treatment for political reasons of this population. And unless we overcome that hurdle, like I said, Congress is not going to resolve this anytime soon.
Gerardo, you've done some research on historic precedent for DACA, and I think you mentioned Brown versus Board being an example. Can you just talk about your research sort of tracing why we are at this sort of breaking point here?
Well, I mean, I think that even before we get to the Brown v. Board of Education, I think one of the things that's important for us to really think about and is to think about this immigration dilemma, if you will, within a historical context and an economic, a social and economic context. What happened in 2007, 2008, right? And there's a lot of research that really indicates that whenever the economy is hurting within the United States, anti-immigrant sentiment is on the rise. Right, and so what we've got right now is we're kind of in the aftermath of all of that happened. But when the stock market was, and when we were having these dilemmas and these problems economically, we were looking for a scapegoat, and I think that's where the anti-immigrant sentiment that we find ourselves in right now as a society, as a country, that's what we really need to be kind of paying attention to. That said, I do think that getting back to some of the issues that were raised with respect to why teachers don't ask and why do administrators not ask, a lot of that is wrapped
or
up in
what
policy.
Their responsibility
yeah,
what their is to these
but
students.
But a lot of that is wrapped up in policy. Mm-hmm. Plyler versus Doe, the 1982 case, I want to say, you know, really, they had a lot of guidelines with the Office of Civil Rights. And the Office of Civil Rights basically said, you know, you cannot create a chilling effect for individuals who are undocumented in schools. And so because of the fact that you cannot create a chilling effect, then that basically means you cannot ask any kinds of questions regarding their background, right? And because you can't ask any questions, then you don't really get to know individuals and their histories and the challenges that they may face. And so consequently, we tend to, as an educational community, we tend to treat individuals, quote unquote, as equals, right? We don't really look at their background. We're not allowed to look at their background. And so by doing so, I think we do students a disservice. By not paying attention to the complexity of the challenges that they may face once they graduate from high school.
So the question is, what kind of impact did that have on you, or did it? I mean, did you have support at home? You know, were you being pushed to keep pursuing an education?
I did. I found a group, Mestizos Arts and Activism, a social justice group of students, of intergenerational artists, poets, of faculty, of different people who really advocated for students of color, and there was actually two undocumented college students who guided me through the process. So it wasn't actually a teacher, it wasn't a college advisor, it was another student who had gone through that process and said, this is the people that you need to talk to, this is what you need to do, this is how you sign up for classes. So it didn't affect me because I was able to find a mentor, somebody who could look after me and say, hey, this is how you can go to college, this is the scholarships you can apply to. But if it wasn't for that, it would have been a lot different for me to try to find all of these resources on my own. I probably would have just worked my way through college, despite having all of the like right qualifications, having it done all right.
Gerardo, you obviously work at the U, and you came from Indiana, and I asked you this, is Utah doing a good enough job to support these students? You know, how does Utah compare to Indiana or
it's
any other place?
Really, really fascinating. I think that Utah is one of the kind of friendlier states, if you will, if you look at the national picture. Actually, it has one of the more progressive policies, despite the fact that it is a majority conservative state. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that, I think, does have to do with the political culture of the state, the religious orientation of the majority religious here, the fact that they were persecuted, marginalized, et cetera, and not wanting to repeat that historical, that negative history to another population. I think that has some sort of effect and impact on the kinds of policies that we're seeing that are being promoted and pushed with respect to immigration in this particular state.
Orrin Hatch was one of the first sponsors of what was, it wasn't called, it was called the Dream Act.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
He was the original, like one of the co-sponsors and writers of the Dream Act.
Right. I think one of the smartest things that the more recent DACA advocates have done, especially young people, was you all remember when many of these young people were marching down, up and down the streets of Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, and many were waving the flags of their Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala. One of the most important changes that they made, because there was a visceral reaction to that, the public said, well, they're Americans and they're waving their flags and they're not real Americans. And I remember very quickly beginning to see many of these protesters, and I went to one not long ago in front of the White House, you did not see a single Mexican flag or Guatemalan flag or Salvadorian flag. I thought it was really smart because there's so much symbolism in that, that, you know, that who are these people that want to reclaim, you know, what they feel is due to them if they're not waving the American flag? It's simplistic, but it's very easy to kind of come to that conclusion. They're foreigners. They're more loyal to that flag than they are to mine. And I think that symbolism can, you know, holds a lot of power, especially these days where we're all getting our news in, you know, 40-second bites.
Well, and I've even heard a debate now over using the term dreamer. And is that okay for journalists to say that? Do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, last time I checked, I think it was okay. But
no, I've been seeing that debate too. Are you staking some kind of claim on that side?
I don't
side?
Remember recently using it. I think I used it only because it was the Dream Act, and it was an acronym for, I don't remember what it was.
Right.
But DACA, you know, Deferred Action Children I don't even remember the acronym for that. But DACA, I think, has kind of filled that void of labeling, which we have to do. And I don't think I've heard anybody say, I don't like that word.
I hear it a lot.
Do you
like DACA? Do you like being called a DACA?
There's a difference being called a DACA recipient and being called a dreamer, because being called a dreamer, it's usually separates us from the rest of our community, saying you are all the good immigrants. You all did it right. And usually when we're talking about dreamers, you talk about the high excelling dreamers, the ones who went to college, the ones who were the top of the class, right? Yeah. But we're not the only ones living in that community. We have people who didn't go to college because college is really inaccessible to undocumented folks. We have people who are working full-time, who have families, who aren't good immigrants, who have criminal background. And being a dreamer often separates you into good immigrant versus being a DACA recipient says you have a worker's permit.
I thought it was clever to use documented.
Uh-huh, yeah.
That was interesting.
No, I think what's fascinating about this conversation, I mean, I'm a child of the 70s, born in in the 70s, raised in the 70s, raised in the 80s, and I remember kind of growing up to this, watching Schoolhouse Rock on the weekends, and there was this Schoolhouse Rock episode, I forgot which one it was, but there was, you know, they would wave the American flag, and then secretly she would say, I'm Polish. So it was like, I'm American and I'm Polish, right? And so somehow that was celebrated, right? And so, and we got this sense that, okay, it was the great American melting pot, I remember, right? And so everybody could come in and we can go into this great American melting pot and everyone can sing a song and be great about it. But we are living in a really interesting time right now. We're no longer the great American melting pot. We are a country where there's, you know, anti-immigrant nativist sentiment like never before. And that is scary. You know, and I think that that's the backdrop of where we are right now. And so I think that, to the point that was being raised, I think that yes, you know, the flag, people waving the flags of their native countries or of their home countries, it means something different now, or people are allowed to express something different now than they did in the past. Why is that the case? Why is that coming up right now and not in the 1970s when we were the great American melting pot? And those are the questions we need to be asking.
Although I have to say, I think history comes and goes in cycles. My uncles came to this country and went back and forth during Operation Wetback under the Eisenhower administration. And, you know, I wrote an essay for NPR on since when, fine, Trump, anti-immigrant, whatever you want to say about his policies or what he proposes to do, but since when have especially Latino children in this country been treated great or fairly? Mm-hmm. I mean, was there a golden age of Latinos, you know, doing well in school because we somehow had a political leadership that was that embraced them? No. Trump is a manifestation of a history of how Latinos have been treated in this country. And so, you know, to be surprised that it is as vehement as it is, maybe for young people and for the newer generations that didn't live through, you know, the 50s and the 40s, mm-hmm. the Bracero program. Mm-hmm. Or you talked about Brown versus Board of Ed. Brown versus Board of Ed was the result of a precedence in Westminster versus Menendez. Mm-hmm. That was the case that gave Thurgood Marshall the model for arguing Brown versus Board of Education. And it was a school district in Orange Grove, California, where Mexican schools were Mexican schools. They were not allowed to mingle with Anglo kids. And by the way, there was an interesting little aside. When we did not long ago an anniversary piece on Brown versus Board of Ed and went to Topeka, Kansas, we were waiting for someone to interview at Sumner Elementary, the school where Linda Brown was not allowed to go in. And one of the janitors comes by, and he asks us, what are we doing? And we say, oh, we're waiting for an interview. And I asked him, how long have you been working here? Oh, I was here when Linda tried to come in. And I said, really? I mean, this guy was in his 90s. Wow. And I asked him, did you have children back there? And because apparently he had been in Topeka for a long time. He says, yeah, I had two children, two daughters. One was very light-skinned, so she was allowed to stay at Sumner. The other one was dark. She had to go to the all-black school. Wow. What a story. Mm. I mean, the story behind the story, right? And you come across stories like that all the time, you know, of how complex this whole issue of race and education is. It's not as simple as we all think it is. Anyway, I went long enough there.
I kind of want to open it up to questions now, if you guys are okay with that. I feel like people have some questions probably burning or lingering at this point. So we have a microphone over here and over there. And don't be shy, because we have a really great panel, as you can tell. And I just want to, Sirik, you should tell people that you were able to renew your DACA paperwork during the most recent period, but some mm-hmm. of your friends have not been able to. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you want to just briefly touch on that so people don't worry too much about you presently.
So when the DACA program was rescinded, I had just like the month before sent in all of my DACA renewal application, and I was able to actually receive it like 2 weeks after DACA was rescinded. But like I was telling Julie, I don't worry just about myself, because while I was able to renew and I have two more years for my DACA, my best friend, hers expires in May, and she's actually trying to become an educator, and she still has two more years of her college education left. And because finding scholarships is hard, she has to be working part-time and then trying to raise money for her own education. So it's not just about worrying for myself, but worrying for other DACA recipients, the ones who couldn't actually renew.
It's a huge community here, too. Mm-hmm. All right.
Tell us your name, too, when you, okay. And if you're a teacher or whatever else you want to share.
I used to be a teacher.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I used to be a teacher in Chile.
Cool.
So I came back here, and, of course, I had a very big love for kids, you know. And the question probably will be with Claudio Sanchez. I usually listen a lot to KUER. And one of the things I have seen myself, doing myself, after, you know, resigned probably because of they didn't have enough money, you know, to have my life. But I have, you know, three children, and they all graduated from university, except the girl still not going to probably one semester more at UCLA. But I would like to ask Claudio, because I have been, I need to tell you a little bit of background so the question he will understand better what I'm trying to say, is that Utah has a special feeling for people that come from outside, and probably because of the LDS culture. In this case, I have read many books about, you know, the past of Utah and Mexico and all Latin America. And because the LDS Church is founded, you know, in especially a Book of Mormon, I have been able to stop a lot of senators like Orrin Hatch. The last letter I wrote to Orrin Hatch and Mike Lee and the president, Trump, was about when he was going to start working, you know, on the immigration. So I said several questions, and I told them, you know, is this your country? I mean, this is your land. Did you buy this land? You know, so people was laughing at me when they said, did you do those questions? I said, sure, I need to ask them. Show me the title. Why do you have a title? And then I said to them also, you know, I said, don't you know who was the first illegal here in you know, in Utah? And everybody was looking, oh, what will it be, you know? And I said, it's very easy. You know, Brigham Young, your own prophet. So, you know, what are you talking about? So after talking several times, because my story is long, but I'm going to shorten it, and then later I can talk to Claudio Sanchez more about that. My question will be, since here they have that background, that we are our children from the same God, it doesn't matter the color, it doesn't have your culture, anything. You know, we have a God that everybody talks different names, but we are the same. We are humans, and also we are have a nobility for being understand that we belong, you know, to a higher ground, you know, that it doesn't belong here, you know. So the question will be, since it becomes so, you know, on the media and, you know, sometimes it's throw it aside, it seems like the people don't want to know the truth. So when I have been in Congress, I made them cry. I make them cry. They cry. Half of them crying. I have passed some law because I went to the base and I said to them, this is what your God will do. And then, of course, they back off. So my question would be, Claudio, what do you think will be a bigger organization or where they will start to move to make people understand that we are all brothers and sisters, that the limits and borders in the country were put for us, for people. It was not put for God himself that created this. So that question will be very important for me to answer that.
Don't hold your breath. I'm sorry to say, and maybe it's because of how jaded I've become, you're not going to have an argument like that in the middle of Congress in devising policy. In this country, we have political borders. We have economic interests. We have labor supply and demand. We have all kinds of things that trump the humanity of this question. You know, should we even have borders is the argument that you're making. Well, clearly, we do. And we're not going to tear them down in order to satisfy such a fundamental thing, which is we're all human beings. We're all brothers and sisters. I mean, it's I don't see that argument going very far. Not that it doesn't have to be made or it should be made, but I guess I live in a place where those arguments go nowhere. And as long as people who are in power don't believe that, you know, that it's even an argument, then what hope is there that anything can change? Only thing I would argue is that, you know, in the story you tell, I mean, you have a role to play as well. You have a role to play in your local community. You know, you grab somebody by the shirt who's maybe never heard that argument. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe that argument will take root.
How about the Native Americans?
Well, of course, talking about another.
And they're treated, you know, differently too.
Of course.
Yeah. So thank you. I appreciate so much.
I'm not sure I help, but.
Thank you. Another questioner.
My name is Leonel Nieto. I'm also a DACA beneficiary, a DACA recipient, a dreamer. Came to the U.S. when I was 11 years old, and I have three questions, and anybody in the panel, if you can talk to these issues. The first one is identity as an immigrant who came here as a child, 11 years old. The question of identity was always big. I never knew who I was. It took me years to figure out if I was Mexican, if I was American, if I was somewhere in between. And I think that had a lot of implications for my educational career or my career path, and also my emotional state of mind. And so the second question is related to that, in how that impacts the academic achievement of many of our youth today, seeing as they're stuck in between this struggle in trying to find identity. And then the third question is related. How has the current political climate exacerbated that? And what are the implications of our future if we're seeing 25%, 30% of the educational population of kids experiencing this kind of anxiety?
Who wants to jump on that?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of different ways to address that particular issue. I think identity is certainly important, and there's a lot of researchers that have looked at the issue of identity from many different angles, whether it was a psychological, sociological, educational element of identity. One of the big issues that, or one of the big theorists out there was John Ogbu. He passed away from UC Berkeley. He talked about that there's two different kinds of minorities in the United States. There's immigrant minorities and there's caste minorities. And what's interesting is that the immigrant minorities, if you look at just across the board, immigrant minorities tend to do very well educationally. They tend to still have the kind of gung-ho spirit of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and what's fascinating, if we look at educationally, they tend to be those who are definitely exceeding above and beyond their caste, if you will, counterparts. Caste minorities, individuals who are, he categorizes them as either individuals who are children of immigrants or folks who were brought here involuntarily, African Americans, Native Americans as well. So there's caste minorities, and if you look at the educational trajectories of caste minorities, they do not do as well as their immigrant counterparts. And so he was positing, beginning to ask why. Why is this the case? And part of the answer that he came about is that the reason why is because their identity is wrapped up in this. The caste minority has already experienced racism. They've experienced oppression. They've experienced kind of a history in some cases, decades or decades and generations of oppression in this country, that they do not think that excelling in this country is even possible. And so they internalize this idea of, you know, then if I can work as hard as I possibly can and I will never make it. Whereas their immigrant counterparts don't have that concealed in whether, and there's a lot of research that supports that, but I do think that there's individuals who have thought about it, there's individuals who are really wrestling with the idea. Suffice it to say that identity work is, and identity research is something that's important. It's something that educators and researchers have certainly thought about and put a lot of work into to try to figure out what's the relationship between the identity of the individual and the kind of outcomes that they have later on in life.
I should say one of Ogbu's best books, I thought, was out of Shaker Heights, Ohio. The study he did on the black-white gap, which was very telling of precisely the points that Gerardo's made. But he looked at African Americans that were affluent and why their achievement levels there was still a gap with their white peers. And talk about a complex, nuanced analysis that he got in trouble for. A lot of trouble for, because even though black parents had recruited him to come in and explain why there was a black-white gap in an affluent community where all the black kids and the white kids were essentially the same socioeconomic class, he came away also kind of pointing the finger and saying, you, the black parents, aren't doing nearly enough for your children. So, you know, for all his good work, he ended up being run out of town.
Thank you for your question. Oh, over there.
Oh, I'm not tall enough for this. Okay. Hi, I'm Lucy. I'm a student at the U, and this one's for Syriac. So you talked about how, like, you were able to go to college, and something that inspired you is that your brother and sister couldn't. And I was wondering, to the extent that you're willing to share, like, what were some of the differences there, like, opportunities you had that got you there that maybe they didn't, and kind of, yeah, if you could explain that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when I was a senior, DACA came out in 2012, and I graduated in 2013. So having DACA really did help because I was able to fund my own education, and I was able to go to school and go to work full time. And for my brother and sister, it wasn't as easy because they weren't ever in the like high achieving classes. They weren't in AP or honors classes, so they were oftentimes just pushed to the sides, which happens a lot to Latino Latina students where they're not motivated because nobody pays attention to them. And I was one of the gifted students, right? Like, you can only be smart because you're gifted, not because you're Latina. And I think a lot of times, for students like my brother and sister, because they're not motivated, because nobody's looking out for them, they weren't able to actually have that, like, even opportunity to believe that they can go to college. And because they weren't able to believe, and because there wasn't DACA, there wasn't really anything that was able to push them to actually get to the point where they could even apply and go to college.
Can I go back to the question that a young man asked about identity, though, and its role in education? The reason that is so hard, especially for teenagers, is because identity or their teenage years are wrapped up in identity, and sometimes it has nothing to do with race, ethnicity, language, or anything. It's just being a kid. I lose track of all the stories I've done where youth culture, whatever seduces young people, whether it's music or the way they dress, how they speak, I mean, that often is more important to young people than being a hyphenated American. And, you know, I'm thinking of a story I did out of just north of Chicago, a school district, very affluent. Well, there were children of Mexican businessmen who went to this school district, but who looked, quote-unquote, American. They were well-to-do. They wore the same clothes that Anglo kids wore. And then there were the other kids who were pretty much ghettoized in the same school, who spoke with an accent, who dressed differently, whose parents were poor. Well, identity in that setting was not ethnic. It was, those are the cool kids and those are not. And there are so many places, so many, especially high schools, where that is an ongoing battle for young people, where the culture that has developed around identity is not the culture that you would think, whether it's language or appearance. It's something else that kicks in. And it's very complicated. I mean, it's hard to kind of do these stories if you're doing a story focused on identity and not delve into that youth culture that happens to be the culture in that school.
But
it's hard.
I also don't think you can separate the race, the class, and gender from that, because like you said, youth culture, right, it's about what you wear, and you are more likely to live in poverty if you're a student of color. So if it's about what you wear, like if you have the latest brand, if you can be up to par to what is cool, it's often connected, related to where you come from, whether it's race, class, gender.
Yeah, sure. I think I would dovetail on both of those points, but I do echo Siriac's point, and to the extent that, yes, I think that youth culture is very powerful, mm-hmm. even when we were all in high school, we all remember, you know, there were the rockers, the stoners, the jocks, the cheerleaders. You know, they everyone had their kind of their group. Yeah, the Breakfast Club. You had your own kind of clique, so to speak, and that was a huge part of the identity. But that's also overlaid over this kind of backdrop of you know, racism and sexism and everything else within the society. And so, you know, you're always kind of negotiating that element of your identity, however so subtle. It's always already present. And you know, and the flip side of that, you also see that manifested within predominantly Latino schools, mm-hmm. in which there's this kind of like internalized oppression that takes place. So that, you know, even in my high school, which was predominant, I went to Roosevelt High School in East LA, Boyle Heights. There were 6,000 kids when I was there in the school. And we still had the quote-unquote wetback building. You know, and this was all Latino. And so even then, you know, we're still kind of like negotiating our own identities in that space, trying to say like, okay, I'm not like them, you know, not like the other, right? And so we still kind of do this thing to ourselves, but that is a different kind of racism in which it's really a reflection, right? It's an internalization of the messages that people are giving you in the mirror. So you don't want that. You don't really want to represent that. That's not you. I don't want that because I know what that means out in society. And so you begin to internalize it and begin to have negative feelings about yourself, your culture, your history, your roots, and everything else.
And believe it or not, I did a story about his school many years ago, and I met a little, and I was assigned a guide to the school, which is the largest at the time, the largest high school west of the Mississippi. What was 6,000 kids? So they assigned me a kid named Randy. His mother was Guatemalteca, his father was Mexican. So this kid's walking around, he's showing me the school, and he's got this big wad of papers in his back pocket, and I said, what do you have there? He says, oh, these are my SAT words. Mm. I say, wait, you, what are you doing with SAT words? Oh, I practice them all the time. He said, why do you practice the SAT words? And he says, because I want to get to college, and I want to have a good vocabulary. And I said, well, don't other kids, your friends, make fun of you for that? Oh, yeah. They go around saying, oh, you think you're better than us, huh? Because you know those big words. And I said, so what do you say to them? Yes, I know those big words, mm-hmm. and I'm going to go somewhere someday. He ended up at Baruch College up in New York. He had been selling, I think he sold enough Rice Krispie treats to pay for something up there. Anyway, to me, you know, he helped me tell the story of how a school of 95% Latinos kind of was at war with itself in terms of how kids divided themselves and in terms of how kids saw themselves. Of course this child saw himself as a Guatemalteco and as a Mexican, as an immigrant. But he also saw himself as an accomplished student, as a smart kid. That identity, as far as I was concerned, was that much more important. It's not a matter of denying who you are. It's a matter of saying, what am I worth? And what does my culture, my language bring to the table?
I think we have time for one more question. And I know that you guys will be willing to talk to people afterwards, too, a little bit. So if you didn't get a chance to, please don't feel afraid to come up and talk to us.
Thanks. I'm Shay, and I am a teacher, and I'm a mom of two kids in the Salt Lake City School District. And I've got a plug and a question. The plug is just, if any of you guys were at the Nicole Hannah-Jones talk, I actually asked about the efficacy of using the term desegregation versus integration, and she said integration. So we got a clipboard. This is just our like first step here. We're not sure what's going to come with the next step. But the clipboard is Salt Lake City Citizens for School Integration, as per Hannah Nicole Jones's advice on that. So if you know what to do with the clipboard after we have it signed, you should put like a little like extra star by your name. And also, if you just want to sign the clipboard because, hey, it's a first step towards something, then sign up with us. And the question is related to journalism because we've noticed as parents and teachers, those of us who are sort of putting together this group, inequities in the Salt Lake City School District, which is not like super surprising, right? I'm sure it's everywhere.
But I feel like we've been hesitant to really go a press route because we feel like public schools are a sort of fragile institution that we're ultimately actually not really interested in super beating up on. We want to be able to root out those inequities and ultimately try to make schools better, but we're afraid of the way often the media portrays public schools in a really, really negative light, and whether that is a good way to continue to support change, evolve public schools for the better. Well, what do you guys think?
Rooting out inequity through basically investigative journalism and sunshine, right?
Well, I've always argued that the best, most powerful, compelling stories are narrow, small, simple stories. You know, you go into a city and you say, this is a story about integration or desegregation or resegregation. I mean, you're taking on a lot. I think what people, certainly NPR listeners, like is stories where they can put meat on the bones of a story, where they can hear a person who speaks to them, who they can identify with. Or even if they don't, people who just in plain English can tell a story of the impact that or how their child was affected by the, because of the fact that he or she went to a school where they rarely saw white people. I mean, Randy, one of the more interesting things he said to me at the end of our interview was, you know, everybody at my school thinks that whites are racist. Plain and simple. They're all racist. And I said, well, you went to New York and came back. Did you come away feeling that you were among racists? He says, no. I met some wonderful people. And yeah, they happen to be white. But the reason he says people think people are racist at this particular school was because they never travel beyond a radius of maybe 20 miles. They never see white people. They only hear about them. And so this disconnect, this lack of proximity, is the wall. And if you, you know, Gary Orfield at UCLA has done probably the most work in saying, here's the impact that resegregation has had on our schools. And it's led to this disinvestment, the sense that they're not our kids, so why should I pay more taxes? Yeah, those kids, they're different than, yeah. I mean, this senseless view of the importance of schools is really the this view is the result of distance and disparities that we can't fix overnight because it didn't happen overnight.
I also think I'm just going to jump in and say that I think most people's perceptions of public schools are based on whether they went to a public school. So I was the beneficiary of a great public education. So I've never, in my own reporting, thought, oh, if I write an article that is perceived as negative, that it's beating up on this institution in some way. I think it's always about making things a little bit better than where you found them. And I think Nicole Hannah-Jones does a really good job of that, too.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is, I've done stories about white parents who pat themselves on the back because they send their kids to a majority-minority school, all black or mostly Latino. And they're so proud of themselves. I walk the walk. I send my kid here because diversity is important to me and blah, blah, blah. Well, when you go to some of these schools, you realize that many white kids in these schools are given special privileges and access to the best programs, to the best teachers. The segregation within schools that are supposed to be integrated, is common. And there was a lawsuit in Richmond, Virginia, years ago, where black parents said, you white parents are essentially the ones being given the best services at this school. You don't even allow black teachers to teach your kids. You want a white teacher to teach your kids. And the argument that white parents had was, well, yeah, but we don't want them to feel like they're isolated. That was their argument. There's a lot of hypocrisy, I think, And this, you know, the rhetoric out there that says, I believe in diversity, but don't sacrifice my child at the altar of diversity. That's my view.
All right. Well, it is time, but I want to thank you all for a really wonderful conversation, for teaching me things. I hope everyone else feels the same way. So if you guys will just give a round of applause for our panel and Claudio Sanchez today. Yeah.